Welcome to COVID Hot Topics, the first in a series of four podcasts derived from an online symposium update on HIV and SARS-CoV-2, for which experts safely gathered in the studios of Roularta. We thank Vive for their support. In the first presentation, Professor Nathan Klumek, Emeritus Professor of Medicine and Infectious Diseases at the Free University of Brussels, Belgium, and at Saint-Pierre University Hospital in Brussels, led off with a comparison of the two modern pandemics, SARS-CoV-2 now and HIV, first recognized some 40 years ago.
It started to be identified in USA in the early 80s, and then go to Africa for really found the origin of HIV. And for SARS-CoV-2, as you know, China, Europe, and then worldwide. HIV was a quickly spreading, but in selected group with behavior, social, and gender issue. Contrary, SARS-CoV-2 is quickly spreading in the general population because the mode of transmission is breathing and everyone is at risk. So HIV is a chronic, non-curable disease, lethal if not treated. SARS-CoV-2 is generally self-limiting, spontaneously curable, and that could be a problem also for the perception of this infection in the population, especially among the young people. And the lethality is related to advanced age and comorbidity. We all know the immunological impact with HIV, immune-mediated depression, and chronic inflammatory then in the chronic phase of the HIV infection. For SARS-CoV-2, we could say that the viral and immune, the immunity is working. I think we have effective humoral and cellular response, but there is the immune overactivation, which is deleterious in a minority of cases and could lead to the death of the patient. So how to measure, to measure the impact for the moment? At the beginning of HIV, the mortality was horrible, 95% of our patients before the treatment. SARS-CoV-2, depending the country, depending the age, depending the morbidity, is around 1%, 4%, and 40% for the people who are aged more than 80. HIV has reached around 40 million cases in 40 years. We are more than 40 million in 1 year with SARS-CoV-2. The impact for HIV was social, societal, what slow but significant. Here we have a wave, we have a tsunami. It's brutal, and the society could go to disorganization, and that's one of the main issues. With an economical impact, the impact was mainly in developing countries for HIV, and now for SARS-CoV-2 everywhere and long term. And we could expect that there will be repetition of the impact from wave to wave until we have a solution that could be treatment, as it was with HIV, or vaccine that everyone is expecting. But when you look at country from country, it's amazing to see the difference in from one country to the other. But the discussion is that both impact HIV and COVID-19, both impact the delicate equilibrium between individual freedom and public health. And there are, of course, common ethical issues. What about the vulnerable groups? What about the double standard of care, the cost of care, the access of therapy? For the moment, these issues are not on the table with SARS-CoV-2, but when we will have treatment, the cost of the treatment will be an issue. When we have vaccine, the access to vaccine will be an issue. But both put a high pressure on the health system.
Professor Klumek noted that one difference between HIV and SARS-CoV-2 is that prevention of HIV is at the individual level with very little or no social control.
And we all remember the period where the behavioral message, be faithful, use condom, was a failure. And really, the progress and the improve in the prognosis of the HIV was when we had the bioprevention for PrEP, TASP, and PEP. For SARS-CoV-2, due to the way the virus is transmitted, we really have a collective versus individual protection and prevention to consider. And it's very, very difficult because we are balancing between a social control and what the people understand and act concerning the prevention. For SARS-CoV-2, trace and isolate is really, really one of the major action that we have to control the epidemic. But even with this reality, we are confronted to the reaction of people. There is a fear of government control. There is a fear of quarantine. Another point is that with HIV, fortunately, health workers were not significantly impacted by HIV. Here we have a lot of nurses, doctors who were infected and who died because of lack of protection. And that's also an issue. In Brussels, in Belgium today, in some hospital, 20% of the nurses and the doctors are out for COVID-19 or because they are exhausted. The age distribution of both entities are very different in terms of morbidity and mortality. What we saw with these pandemics is the pandemics of fake news and conspiratory theories. These theories and fake news have a negative impact in the control, of course, because there are naive people who believe that. There are people who are manipulators. We use this fake news for a political issue. And in HIV, the beginning was the virus was being created by CIA to genocide black population. HIV is not causing AIDS. It's a lack of hygiene and poverty. And today, only in some social network, you have still such conspiratory theories. But for SARS-CoV-2, it's all every day you have a new theory which is coming. And the conspiracy of Bill Gates, of Soros, is one among others. And the difference between HIV at the beginning and now is the role of social media. You send something in internet, immediately you have it in Instagram, and everyone is aware of that and transmit it to other people. And one of the difficult issue, is the role of non-believers politicians. It's quite incredible, but there are politicians who don't believe the reality of this epidemic. So despite major difference in terms of epidemiological dynamic, clinical aspect, and public health impact, HIV and SARS-CoV-2 have some interesting similarity, and we can reach lessons from both pandemics. The principal lesson is pathogenesis. This concept is that disease prevention requires a global, comprehensive, multidisciplinary, and integrated approach. And this approach should permit a revisiting of our knowledge about infectious disease, but probably also non-infectious entities.
Pathocenosis, a term proposed in 1969 by medical historian Mirko Gurmek, considers a disease in all of its contexts, the qualitative and quantitative pathological states of the host population at a given time, including its historical and geographic dimensions. According to Gurmek, the frequency and distribution of each disease depends on both endogenous and ecological factors. Endogenous factors include infectivity, virulence, route of infection, and vector, while ecological factors take into account climate, urbanization, promiscuity, as well as the frequency and distribution of all the other diseases within the same population. Thus, this naturalistic view sees disease in its complete context. And Professor Klumek delineates three lessons for responding to the COVID-19 pandemic.
First, we need to anticipate. We need to anticipate health inequality. We must track the socioeconomic status and gender of those affected and extend to track the economic impact. Public health initiatives must overcome barriers to reach. It's nothing to say, put a mask, don't move. People have to accept that and have to change their behavior. It's very difficult. Second, create an enabling environment to support behavioral change. Just an example, just as gender-based violence hinder safer sexual behavior, choice for women, the scarcity of clean water will limit hand washing in developing countries. And third and last, a multidisciplinary effort is essential, and social and behavioral theory is relevant here to complement the epidemiology theory in the models.
Our next presenter is Professor Dr. Bart Lambrecht of the Pulmonary Medicine Department at Ghent University in Ghent, Belgium, speaking about COVID-19 disease and opportunities for immunotherapy. He relates how the pathogenesis of COVID-19 can explain the action of certain drugs and so may guide ongoing and future therapeutic developments. He says the disease is biphasic, the first phase of which is a viral phase where people have mild constitutional symptoms, fever, and feel somewhat sick, possibly with upper airway symptoms.
But then in a subgroup of patients, this disease rapidly progresses into a more pulmonary disease with symptoms of dyspnea and eventually in some people evolving to a real severe ARDS image where they require mechanical ventilation and further life support. So it's obvious that depending on where you are in this disease spectrum, if you're early in the disease, we're going to treat this with antivirals. Whereas when you're later in the disease, you might be requiring different forms of therapy to handle the problem. And these people should be immediately ventilated and treated aggressively. So in some of these patients, this is also associated or accompanied by overproduction of inflammatory mediators. We've heard a lot in the media about so-called cytokine storm or the cytokine release syndrome. So what is this exactly? So in a subgroup of patients, you will have sustained fever. Even though 10, 15 days after the initial symptoms, they will still have fever up to 39 to 40 degrees. There's progressively more pancytopenia, so they start dropping their lymphocytes. Also, very strikingly, eosinophils are down, whereas neutrophils tend to be up in the disease. There's also a profound increase in CRP, which is odd because CRP is normally associated with bacterial infections. And here we have a virus causing this CRP increase. They have very high and rising ferritin levels. They have high triglycerides. They show signs of coagulation and they rise their D-dimers, progressively the liver function starts to fail, transaminases go up, and there's progressively more organ dysfunction. So this has been nicknamed the cytokine storm. It's probably more appropriate to talk about the cytokine release syndrome, because it's not really the typical storm that we also see with CAR T-cell therapy.
He explained that the lung is a very delicate organ with a very thin alveolar capillary membrane of only 0.3 micrometers thick, since it is needed for gas exchange. So the lung has to be protected, but not to such an extent that the lung would swell because of inflammation, preventing gas exchange from the presence of all the inflammatory cells. Being a very hard organ to defend, Professor Lambrecht said evolution devised a very good trick.
evolution has put down alveolar macrophages in the lungs. And alveolar macrophages, you can compare them as vacuum cleaners. They are there on the inside of the alveoli. They capture everything that's inhaled, including dust particles or cigarette smoke. They will capture viruses and neutralize them without causing a lot of inflammation. They also handle surfactant very well, making the lung to expand, and they keep T cells in check. And then here comes COVID-19. So COVID-19 infects not only the lung epithelial cells, which are lining the alveoli, the virus also directly infects the vacuum cleaners. So this is a big, big problem in this infection. The cells that normally control homeostasis are destroyed very, very early in the disease process. And there's also some infection of endothelial cells. Remember, they're only 0.3 micrometer away, and early in the disease, the virus infects lung endothelial cells, which express ACE2 receptor. So, and then the immune system kicks in, and initially this is very good. So as the cells are being infected, they pump up production of type 1 interferon, and type 1 interferon is a good thing. It's going to cause an antiviral state, and it's very necessary to keep the virus in check. There is also going to be some early cytokine production like TNF-alpha, IL-1, IL-6, and this is completely fine in the beginning of the disease process because you need that to fire up the immune system and help to clear the virus. So what happens next? So the vacuum cleaners are gone, homeostasis is lost, and then it really becomes an acute lung injury problem. So the virus will progressively infect more capillary endothelial cells. This causes microthrombi very, very early in the disease, and it causes contraction of the lung endothelial cells. And when these cells contract, they become leaky, and you get fluid leaking out of the blood vessels into your alveoli. And it's literally like your lung is drowning in fluid. It becomes worse and worse because the thrombi that initially are only found in the capillaries will progressively spread out of the capillaries and will start filling up the alveolar space. The damaged alveolar basement membrane is now covered with fibrin, with clotting factors. And at this stage of the disease, you will see that many people already have signs of increased D-dimers because those fibrin deposits, also called hyaline membranes in the older literature, are being remodeled. So this early increase we see as a biomarker of D-dimers is in fact a sign that there's full-blown ongoing acute lung injury in your patient. And these fibrin deposits are pretty nasty because they will activate the CRP, which is circulating already in your body. The CRP is activated. The CRP activates complement, and complement C3 and C5 are very, very strong chemotactic signals for recruiting inflammatory cells in the lung. And then we end up with full-blown acute lung injury in the most severe cases of SARS-CoV-2, where you will have recruited monocytes and neutrophils that respond to the complement, come into the lung, and further fire up the whole process because they start producing those cytokines, and this is when you end up in the cytokine storm. And so the healthy vacuum cleaners are replaced by pro-inflammatory disease-causing macrophages. So this is a disease of macrophage and neutrophil accumulation in the lung. And then with or without a cytokine storm, you see progressively more IL-6, more TNF-alpha, more IL-1 activation, more IL-18, more IL-10, more chemokines. So there is no doubt that there is a cytokine activation syndrome happening in these patients. And it's going to be really crucial to identify which of these cytokines is a key cytokine. So which one could be a therapeutic target? And then the final stage of the disease where everybody is really afraid of is, will these people progress to lung fibrosis? That's the big question for the coming months to years. If you have had a severe ARDS, you're always a bit at risk for developing lung fibrosis. So how can this happen? So with every ARDS, when the lung starts trying to heal itself, because the lung has a very strong intrinsic healing capacity, the epithelial cells go into overdrive, where you you see that the alveoli are no longer lined with a simple unicellular, single-cell layer, but there is a complex multicellular layer, and this is called type 2 pneumocyte hyperplasia. So these type 2 pneumocytes produce pro-fibrotic cytokines, and the fibroblasts can actually grow all the way into the alveolar space. And this is called cryptogenic organizing pneumonia. So it's fibroblasts growing into the lung. You see that the alveoli are completely filled with young fibroblasts. Those fibroblasts can still go away. They respond very well to corticosteroids. And this is also why we are currently giving our patients corticosteroids. So we're giving them, as soon as they have hypoxia, we give them systemic dexamethasone in an attempt to get rid of those pro-fibrotic fibroblasts.
Professor Lambrecht said that he and others around the world are conducting trials to block specific cytokines individually or in combination to control inflammation in the lung.
We have also run a trial where we're trying to restore the homeostasis, turning the pro-inflammatory monocytes into vacuum cleaners. And how can you do this? It's with giving inhaled GM-CSF, the cytokine that's telling a monocyte to become a vacuum cleaner is GM-CSF. But the key will be, for the coming years or months, will be patient selection. There's no doubt that these cytokine blockade therapies could benefit some patients, but they will probably not benefit everybody. So it's really going to be down to personalized medicine. And there are a lot of trials currently ongoing blocking various cytokines or complement or coagulation pathway that might give us some hints on how we have to tackle this disease. And I think the things for the future are restoring homeostasis and preventing fibrosis after a couple of weeks into this disease.
We thank our speakers, Professor Klumek and Professor Lambrecht, for their enlightening messages about future approaches to better treatments of SARS-CoV-2, and thank you for listening. Please be sure to listen to our upcoming podcast from the symposium, Update on HIV and SARS-CoV-2. And again, we thank Vive for their support.